Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 43 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the children's writer Eleanor Updale speaks with Conor McPhee about all ages writing, the ills of contemporary education, and the wonder of London's underground sewers. Eleanor Updale writes award-winning fiction for children and adults. In the 1970s and 80s, she was a BBC radio and television producer, specialising in politics and current affairs. More recently, she's acquired a PhD in history and taken an interest in medical ethics. She's a lay member of the Clinical Ethics Committee at Great Ormond Street Hospital and of the UK Donation Ethics Committee. Eleanor is a former governor of the children's charity Quorum and a trustee of the Esme Fairbairn Foundation. She lives in Edinburgh and London, and we spoke at her home in Edinburgh. First of all, Ellie, you had a long career in the media as a radio and TV producer. Was that media background useful when it came to the professional side of being a writer?
I think it's been terribly useful. I think one of the great things about doing stuff for broadcasting is that you are always writing for the ear. And I very much still write for the ear rather than the eye, although I know people are going to read it with their eyes. The great trap is to write for the eye and not the ear. And it's really a great gift the BBC gave me, teaching me how just to write straightforwardly, and so that you get the message first time. You shouldn't have to read a sentence twice to find out what it means.
I imagine there's also good lessons about getting things finished. When you're in the media, you have very strict deadlines and you have to meet them, and that's quite a good discipline.
It's discipline, but it's also a cop-out. I think a lot of us who have learned to rely on deadlines use them as an excuse for not getting things perfect. Now, sometimes that's good, because sometimes trying to get things perfect means you never actually do them at all. But sometimes you do hide behind the fact that if you're scrambling to get something on the air, you can be proud at the end that you didn't fall off the air. Something got there in the end, but you're not too worried about whether it was any good. So you have to balance the two.
Now, some genres of writing have always been pretty badly paid. Poetry and short stories spring to mind. But something that's been happening very much in recent years is that mid-list fiction and non-fiction authors are also having an increasingly hard time. You know, their advances are much smaller, people are being dropped by their agents and their publishers. Would you say that the media's current approach to writers and to books is helping or hindering mid-list writers in particular?
Well, I think everything's hindering mid-list writers. It really exasperates me that if a writer, even a fairly unknown writer, is on a programme on the radio, I can guarantee you that the second line of the script introducing them will be about how much money they've earned, not even about how many books they've sold. Somehow, really in the sort of Harry Potter time, the media got the idea that writing meant money, and that is how people are judged, and it's very sad. Although, a lot of people who make a lot of money out of writing are never on the media because of a different kind of snobbery. So a lot of Mills and Boon authors, who are probably the highest earning regular authors in this country, you wouldn't know the names of any of them, neither would I. But sales, sales, sales. You know, I can remember a time when people didn't really talk about sales. The same as in the BBC. When I first worked in the BBC, as a producer, you were not allowed to know what your programme budget was. There was somebody above you who held the budget and would occasionally raise the alarm and say, listen, guys, you know, we're getting near to the end of this year's budget. But if you were doing that day's programme and a war had just broken out in Africa and you needed a satellite in order to interview the person who was at that war, you weren't allowed to think about the budget. Now, that was probably too far the other way. Probably it is a good idea to know how much things cost. But now everything's all about money and what is the return on things. That's one of the reasons, of course, that authors aren't given the time to find their feet. Books aren't given the time to find their feet. And quite often, I'll find a book that somebody recommends to me that they maybe read 2 or 3 years ago and love it, only to discover it's now out of print. even a decade ago, part of the book's natural life would have been that slow burn up to becoming established.
It does very much seem these days the difference between being on the shelf in Tesco and complete oblivion, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And when you think of who are the people who are making that decision and whether they're making it on literary grounds or entirely retail grounds, talking about how many inches of shelf space generate how much money, for our generation, it goes against the grain to think of literature in that way.
Now, you describe your Montmorency novels as being suitable for anyone who likes a meaty story, whatever their age. Do you think there's a difference between being a writer for children and a writer for all ages? And if there is one, do publishing houses recognise it?
I think people are in a complete mess over this. I do, of course, see that there are things which are children's books for very small children. Though, of course, most of those are also books for adults, because for a lot of people, it's the adult who's delivering the story. And I do think that the least you can do if you're writing one of those is to put in some content for the adults, even if it's just a joke in the illustration, but it might well be a subtext running throughout.
Because yes, we'll all know Postman Pat and the Bees off by heart.
Exactly. I mean, if there's one person I want to murder, it is Postman Pat. Apart from the book I secretly want to write, which is Spot's Last Walk, where he goes out and gets run over. That would be fabulous for me. That book caused me so much pain because it was adored by my children who just wanted it repeated and repeated and repeated. But I didn't mind, for example, reading and rereading and rereading Jill Murphy's books, you know, A Piece of Cake and Peace at Last, things like that, which are full of jokes for the parents all the way through. Obviously, there are books that are children's books. But once somebody gets to the stage of having some kind of reading fluency or comprehension ability that means something can be read to them, if the story's good, it's good for anybody. I don't understand publishers targeting, as they see it, 9 to 12s, 12 to 14, young adult, teen, because what you're actually doing is excluding. If you say to somebody, this book is fit for somebody aged 12 to 14, you're saying that everybody aged under 12 or over 14 is not fit for them. Ridiculous. Why cut your market down like that?
So Martin Amis controversially said a little while ago, and I quote, "If I had a serious brain injury, I might well write a children's book, but otherwise the idea of being conscious of who you're directing the story to is anathema to me." That might be a deliberately provocative overstatement. And it begs the question, do writers of children's novels have to be any more aware of their prospective audience than writers in any other genre? And can any published writer actually be oblivious of who their audience is?
I know it was a deliberately controversial remark. And of course, it was profoundly insulting to anybody who actually does write children's books. But the second half of what he had to say, that the idea of targeting your book is anathema to him, I couldn't agree with that more. When I'm writing, I don't feel that I'm writing for children, except in one regard. I wouldn't put explicit depraved sex in a book. I wouldn't put easily outdated slang in a book, because I know that if I put outdated slang in it, they're just going to say, who is this jerk? Actually, to be perfectly honest, I'm hiding behind the children's label to get out of having to write sex scenes. You know, if I was sitting on the psychiatrist's couch now, what we would be revealing is the reason that my first books were officially children's books is because it got me out of having to write about sex.
How about violence?
Violence I find difficult to write. I find violence very, very difficult to read. Just, as I might say, well-written violence. Harder even than to watch on the screen, which I find hard enough. I've put violence in my books. I find it's more effective if it's very, very understated. And sometimes it's much more effective to describe somebody recovering from a violent attack than to show the violent attack. Much more powerful. So, you know, you won't find in any of my books gruesome, you know, accounts of stabbings or things like that. But you'll find all the build-up, all the threat, all the terror, and maybe hear some of the sounds. But then you're very much more likely 6 weeks later to have somebody who can't turn over in bed because of the pain. And I think that's more effective.
I think the thing that I always feel most like protecting my children from is actually cruelty, particularly in films. Deliberate cruelty is something I'm quite uncomfortable with. And yet children are often so cruel to each other. So how does cruelty fit in?
You don't put cruelty in on purpose. You may have cruel people. You may have amoral people and have within the book some kind of explicit or implicit discussion about why they're like that. I do think for young people, one of the things about reading or watching television or doing video games is about playing with the world. I think the best thing that we can do in our books is give children a chance to experience something safely. So you might, for example, have a child, young adult, who does something that turns out to be a very, very bad idea. Much better to take the reader on their journey with them and almost experience it through them and then come to a conclusion. But you can't bang them on the head with the message. That does not work at all.
Do you ever set out to be explicitly didactic, or does that just emerge organically?
I think it emerges organically, but there end up being messages. In the end, I think any book that's any good comes out with the message that life may be unfair, good may not always triumph, but it sort of feels better to be kind than unpleasant. And it's worth considering before you hit the lady over the head with the milk bottle what it might be like to be that old lady. And I think that's one area where we're actually falling quite short in all kinds of areas of creative work, is this putting people in other people's lives. There's been this enormous craze in children's fiction, which I'm glad to say is wearing off a bit now, of feeling that all books ought to be relevant to the lives of children reading them. And, you know, this terrible thing teachers do about making people write essays about which character do you identify with, which they take to mean which character is most like you, which is complete rubbish. The point of reading is to encounter people who are nothing like you, and maybe to think, oh, I'd like to live a life like that. But also to be told, okay, you can live a life like that, but this is what might happen next. How lovely to have that experience in the warmth of your own home and not out on the streets. But there are dangers. For example, again, looking back 5-10 years, the huge, huge fashion for victim literature, both in the adult field and in the children's field, which I think has damaged some people who had the misfortune to be at a certain period of their development at the moment when that was fashionable, into feeling you're not special unless you're damaged. You're not valuable unless someone's hurt you. These days people almost have to apologise for having a happy life and almost don't notice it if they've got it, because there really ought to be something wrong. And so I like to think that the books I write don't encourage that. But at the same time, I wouldn't go around banging people over the head saying, don't be a victim.
To return for a minute to the idea of writing for an audience, there does seem to be a pattern that really excellent children's fiction, such as Philip Pullman's Golden Compass, is equally popular with adults as it is with children. You know, I'm not sure that would happen if the author was deliberately writing down to children as opposed to just writing about themes that children happen to relate to, which, of course, adults can relate to too, because we all were children once. Is that the recipe for truly successful all-ages books?
Yeah, the recipe for all-ages books is to tell a good story. But, in fact, there's no recipe. I mean, the minute you start talking about recipes, you're in trouble. That's why I'm perhaps a little over-cynical about creative writing courses and so on, where a lot of the teachers are very good, but I think maybe a lot of people who sign up for them think that what they're going to get is take a very successful book, unpick it to find out how it was made, turn that into a template where if you follow the recipe and turn the handle, the bestseller will come out the other end. That's not how it works. That's why so many people are so disappointed by their creative writing courses, because they think, well, I've spent all this money, where's the bestseller?
Yes, or even just the publishing contract, actually, let alone the bestseller. You know, I think some of the universities market these things in a somewhat cynical way as well, I think.
They're great money spinners for the universities.
Yes. something that certainly seems to have happened in the States, where these programs are much more established and widespread, is that the career path seems to become do an MFA, teach on an MFA program, and actually writing or having books published has become secondary to that, which does seem quite odd. And presumably, like a pyramid scheme, it has to stop somewhere because they'll run out of new MFA programs to...
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But it's hard to see the end of it. And it is true. Just an anecdotal story about a friend of mine who was teaching on an MA creative writing course and had one customer from overseas who had real problems with literally writing a sentence, couldn't do it. And she nursed him through virtually by doing his work for him and then asked him what he was going to do next. And guess what the answer was? I'm going to teach creative writing. It will go on and on and on. One of the sad things is some of the people from these courses go into publishing. And they then think that there is this magic template you could do. And they start talking about story arcs and all these sort of structural things, which no author in their right mind thinks of for 5 seconds when actually writing. Maybe aware of them. And also just knows if something's getting boring, you don't need to analyse it in those terms.
Do you feel there are parts of fiction writing that can be taught?
It's a craft as well as an art. Certainly the craft can be taught. Fortunately for some of us, we were taught it when we were so young that it's just part of our being now. So I think the basic appreciation of language, little rules like, you know, don't use the same word all the time, don't use the same phrases all the time. That's part of the craft, just as if you were teaching somebody to make a table, you would teach them to make all the legs the same length. There's all that in writing. And there's also things like mastering your technology, a role in which I failed tremendously. But it is part these days of writing. You have to know if your publisher is going to want something submitted as a work document. You have to know how to produce a decent-looking Word document. That's all craft. That can be taught. The art of writing can't really be taught from scratch. People can say things to you which profoundly change your attitude to your art. That's how artists have worked through time. They've always gathered together in gangs and said, how do you do this? Have you seen the way he did that? And of course, for a writer, reading is what gives you that. It becomes very difficult, after you've been writing fiction for a while, to read a fiction book without asking yourself all the time you're reading, oh, see, look at that. Isn't that clever? Or the opposite, you know, for goodness sake. And some books, you almost want to have a pen in your hand just to change some of the words, just to give it that bit more power. I don't think anyone can sit down with you and do that. That has to come from yourself.
So a big, big part, intuition and instinct.
Intuition, instinct. And would I like to read this book? I mean, this is a question that a lot of people don't seem to ask themselves. They look at what's the market, you know. Oh, there's a big market for vampire fiction at the moment. I'll write a vampire fiction book. Well, unless you actually want to write a vampire fiction book, you're doomed. There was one stage recently where I had 5 friends who had each been asked by their publishers to write books about angels, because it was thought at the time angels were going to be the next big thing. As it turned out, they weren't. But none of these 5 people wanted to write a book about angels.
It's an interesting question for a children's writer, actually, you know, to ask yourself that question, is this a book I'd like to read?
Well, I think you have to. Children aren't a different species. The idea that they need a completely different literature is bonkers. I mean, the first book I wrote, because I was flying blind completely, and I didn't know anything about the world of children's books, and I just wrote what I thought was a good story. As it turned out, there were no children in this story. And this caused quite a stir. I hadn't noticed, my agent hadn't noticed, my children hadn't noticed, but the first few publishers who got it noticed. And one even said, and if you've read Montmorency, you'll know how daft this is. One even said, could she be persuaded to turn the main character into a 13-year-old boy? Well, no. You know, it's a man. And, you know, 13-year-old boys are allowed to understand how men think and what they do. And as I say, there's no flagrant sex or anything like that, but people are just people.
Something that's always seemed a bit unfair to me is that adult fiction writers get to swan off to literary festivals and eat canapes in the author's year, whereas children's writers have to go to schools and do these incredibly demanding workshops, you know, keeping large groups of children engaged and attentive. I know of all the workshops that I've done that the schools ones were both the most daunting and the most exhausting as well. Some schools obviously are really supportive of visiting writers, but you do hear some terrible stories as well of schools that aren't. So is there a bit of exploitation going on?
Well, it's two-way. I mean, for some children's writers, it's their only source of income now, because the returns on writing children's books are so small. And there is this bizarre thing in publishing that children's writers are treated as if they're children. So advances are smaller than for an adult book. Now, it takes just as long to do one as the other. It's just as skilled. It's a different job, but it's just as skilled. I think it's up to the author to make sure that he or she is not exploited. One of the big, big problems, though, is that, of course, because we are engaged with the world of young people, we all feel that there is this national emergency on our hands of either literacy problems or lack of reading, or lack of opening the door to reading to children. Because of the way the education system works now, very many people who are teaching have never had the experience of reading for pleasure. They think reading is a task to be done. They're given the job of teaching it as a chore. And so some of us feel it's good to get in there to say to people, hey, did you know what? You can just read a book. You know, you can read a book and you have the right to remain silent. You don't have to analyze it. You don't even have to tell anyone you've read it. It's your thing. So it's very attractive to go into school and do that and to sort of spread a certain amount of black propaganda about, you know, fighting against the educational machine. So is it exploitation? Yes and no. It's very hard. And there are schools that will use you as a supply teacher. You know, you're really just doing a lesson. Now, one of the big, big problems is that a lot of children's writers were once teachers, and they will prepare a worksheet. They might even, in some cases, even arrive with a lesson plan. Now, this makes life more difficult for the likes of me, who want to sort of, frankly, swan in as a different kind of being, talk about a different kind of world, tell a story, tell the kids they could be writers. You know, they can be readers, they can be writers, they can decide. There is a world outside the education machine.
What do you think is the best way of engaging children with reading?
Let them read what they like. Not be censorious. And if all they want to read is the back of a cornflake packet and the text messages on their phone, up to a point, that's all right. Presenting it as a chore is the worst you can do. I remember once a book had come through the post. It was a really good book. And I said to my daughter, who must have been about 7 at the time, oh, you should read this. It's really, really good. And she said, I haven't got time. I've got to do my reading. And she had one of these bleak little school readers. And she was being diligent. She was doing her reading when she had the option of reading. And that was tragic. The other thing is realizing that every child gets there in their own way. For a long, long time, people said, oh, boys don't read anymore. Boys don't read. The truth is that, this is a huge generalization, but part of it's true, boys read differently. You know, you will find boys with books of lists. You know, I remember my own son, obsessed when very, very young, with a book about the history of every train crash. That was reading. These kids are decoding print all the time now. The tragedy is, if they're not looked after in the early stage, when they get the basic reading skill, and I still cannot understand how it's possible to go through a British school and come out at the end unable to read. I think that's wicked, because we know from wonderful work, say, that's done in prisons, there's a scheme called Toe by Toe, where inmates who can read can teach an inmate who can't read to read in 3 months. This is somebody who's been neglected entirely by the system, can be end up reading books. You know, it's not a myth.
The tremendous pressure to dissect the books as well, I think, must be terribly off-putting if you're already nervous about reading, to feel that you're about to be quizzed about it.
Who ever liked doing it? This is a great myth. Who ever liked talking about why a book is how it is? And, you know, this awful thing, I mean, I remember hating it when I was at school, comprehension. I was once in a school and a teacher said to me, oh, I liked your book so much, I set a paragraph from it for comprehension. I could have murdered this woman. I think that's a wicked, wicked thing to do. And also, so much of it is absolute rubbish that you see. It's like those books you get now where In the back, there'll be suggested questions for book clubs. What a load of rubbish. If you can't read a book and think of your own questions, throw it out the window.
And you know, it's funny, I'm in a book reading group, and the books that I most like are the ones I feel least inclined to talk about. Mm. I don't know why, but, you know, I've enjoyed the book for itself. I don't want to talk about
it. It's not a natural thing. I mean, if you see a lovely picture in an art gallery, you don't turn to the person next to you and say, isn't it wonderful the way he's juxtaposed the purple with the blue and then thought of those little fine brushstrokes? Now, a professional artist will be thinking that. But it's not what the artist wanted you to see. An artist doesn't want you to see the scaffolding that's gone up around this thing to make it work. They want you to see the finished thing. It's wicked what's going on.
In Montmorency, you describe your hero's first encounter with the stench of the underground sewers, which he uses to carry out burglaries. And you describe this with really a rather heartfelt vividness. So was that from personal experience?
Well, that's quite interesting. It isn't. But to tell you the answer backwards, after I'd written the books, I was allowed to go down the London sewers because I'd written the books. It's very, very, very difficult these days to get down the London sewers because of security and things. So I just read a great deal. And I had seen, when I was young, Blue Peter seemed to go down the sewers sort of every 6 months. And so I felt as if I'd been down the London sewers. And I read, as I say, read a great deal. And I imagined a lot. But also, when I was a child, I lived in a big block of flats, and the sewer collapsed next to our flats. And so for what seemed like months, but was probably just a couple of weeks, we lived with that smell. And it's still a smell that I recognise. I know now if the sewer's in trouble, just walking up Morningside Road, I can smell it. And there was a time, actually, when there was clearly a problem underneath Foyles in London, where if you went into the lift by their cafe, you could smell the smell. So I knew that, and I could sort of guess and put things together. When I actually got to go down the sewers, which is the most wonderful day out you can imagine, just spellbinding, there was lots of reassurance for me about things that I'd guessed or read that turned out to be right. The only thing I got wrong, well, I didn't get it wrong because I didn't say anything, but the thing I would have mentioned had I known, is that when you walk along the base of the sewer is quite gravelly. You know, there's a lot of debris and stuff down there. It's quite crunchy. And I hadn't allowed for that. I'd imagined it being fairly smooth. I think the sewers are fascinating simply because without them, we would all die. They keep us going, and we are completely in denial about their existence. We were talking about going into schools. You see, I don't talk about how you structure a story. I talk about why you mustn't throw chip fat down the sink and what happens to it when it gets into the sewer. Because I've seen it now, you see. I've seen these icebergs of fat that clog up the arteries of London. And, you know, little facts that children like. These are what they call Q-tips, cotton buds. They're exactly the right size to get stuck in the filters in the sewers. If you wanted to bring London to a standstill, just tip a load of cotton buds down the sewers. Finished.
Oh, dear, we'd better not broadcast that, I think.
No. Hello, Al Qaeda. There's your... Never mind taking mascara on a plane.
So finally, Ellie, what does a good day look like to you?
A good day of what? A good day of writing?
A good day.
What does a good day look like to me? Let me think. You see, what I should say, isn't it? I wake up and I pick up the book I was reading the night before and get stuck back into reading that. And then, having read that, I leap to my machine and create and think. A good day to me is the beautiful, beautiful Scottish sunlight that we get some days, walking out with the dog, thinking about other things, running into a friend I haven't seen for a long time. Nice to have a couple of ideas for something good to do and to hope that I'll be able to hold on for them for long enough to do them. But also, all the things you're not supposed to say you like doing, like watching something really brilliant in the cinema or on the telly, going to a fantastic play, having something really lovely to eat. I'm not saying the right thing. I should say it's being locked in the shed at the bottom of my garden, doing my 4,000 words that I promise myself I'll do every day. I don't live like that.
Ellie Updell, thank you very much for talking with us.
That's fine, thank you.
That was Eleanor Updell in conversation with Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Eleanor on her website at www.eleanorupdale.com. And that concludes episode 43, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee.
Coming up in episode 44, we have the second part of George Miller's interview with travel writer, biographer and translator Julian Evans, in which Julian speaks further about his biography of Norman Lewis, the purpose of biography and the biographer's obligations, and what Norman might have made of the book. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.